Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and a running theme of this election cycle has been the ghosts of positions past haunting candidates on the trail, from Rubio's support of immigration reform to Hillary Clinton's former position on gay marriage to Donald Trump's former position on, well, a lot of stuff. One ghost that has haunted both Bernie and Hillary is their support of the 1994 crime bill and the era of mass incarceration that it helped bring about. Clinton, in particular, has had to defend her husband's signing of the tough-on-crime law. She has argued that the bill was a response to the black community's demands to get tough on crime. My next guest recently co-wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that calls this kind of defense of the crime bill, which Sanders also voted for, selective hearing. She also has a new book out next week that traces this theme of selected hearing back to the Johnson-era anti-crime policies. So here to discuss this with me is Dr. Elizabeth Hinton, professor of history and African-American studies at Harvard. This new book is called From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Hi, Professor Hinton. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And you weren't writing a book for the Democratic primary, I don't think. So what's your main larger point as it relates to that crime bill?
The 94 crime bill?
Yeah.
Or the Johnson amendment?
Well, let's start with 94 and we'll go back.
So we see this, Veshla Weaver, Julia Kohler-Houseman, my co-authors, and I see the crime bill more as a process of the selective hearing of black voices. Black Americans have historically, from emancipation onwards, called for better policing, and politicians instead tend to hear more policing. This trend of selective hearing has a number of features, the first being that those furthest from the lived experience of crime and violence have greater power in determining responses, various responses, usually punitive responses to crime and violence, calls for better protection. More police in communities are frequently accompanied with a critique of police brutality, calls for employment programs, calls for comprehensive prevention programs that include early childhood education, et cetera. And what ends up happening is the politicians tend to respond to the punitive calls and ignore the kind of larger calls for more social welfare provisions, greater access to resources, et cetera.
So do you think that's what happened with that defense that President Clinton gave just recently in the back and forth that he had with some Black Lives Matter protesters about black support for the 94 crime bill? I want to play just 16 seconds of that
sure.
recent incident with Bill Clinton.
I talked to a lot of African-American groups. They thought Black Lives Mattered. They said, take this bill because our kids are being shot in the street by gangs. We have 13-year-old kids planning their own funerals. She don't want to hear any of that.
And I've heard the stat that 2/3 of the Congressional Black Caucus voted for it. I haven't been able to fact check that myself. But if that's true and what Clinton was saying is true, was that all just selective hearing as you see it?
Well, 26 of the 38 voting members of the Congressional Black Caucus ended up supporting the bill. There's another story behind that. With respect to Clinton's comment, I think this represents an offshoot of the selective hearing trend, which is that consistently the onus for socioeconomic problems, poverty, inequality, et cetera, is increasingly placed and framed on African American communities. So we see this stemming back to Johnson's War on Poverty, where policymakers do acknowledge racial discrimination to be a major factor explaining urban inequality and unrest in American cities. And instead, the response of policymakers through War on Poverty programs is to deal with racial discrimination by changing the behavior and the quote-unquote pathological problems that they perceived in African-American communities. And we see this kind of rhetoric and these ideas bubbling up again in Clinton's response to the Black Lives Matter protesters. Instead of thinking in a larger framework about what the root causes are of some of crime, violence, et cetera, in vulnerable communities, and the ways in which policies and incarceration itself contributes to that violence in some ways. You know, he deflects and draws attention to what many call black on black crime.
So why 26 of 38 voting Congressional Black Caucus members selecting the yes button.
So part of what we trace in the article is the development of this crime bill from 93 when it was introduced by Chuck Schumer and Senator Joe Biden through the Congressional Black Caucus's amendments to the bill and their Racial Justice Act. Originally, the Congressional Black Caucus saw this as an opportunity to get prevention funding to their constituents living in vulnerable communities with high rates of reported crime and suffering from high rates of drug abuse. And these social welfare provisions, these aspects of the bill, were consistently slashed by policymakers and Republicans. So in the end, the prevention funding, Republicans like Bob Dole refused to pass the bill with the kind of initial amounts of prevention funding that the Congressional Black Caucus wanted. And the many representatives who ended up voting for the bill did so because with the little prevention funding that was still in the bill, this was the only way they could get social welfare provisions to their constituents. And they worried that if this bill did not pass, a more draconian bill with harsher sentencing would. The other aspect of it is that in 93, the federal government's own sentencing commission discovered gross racial disparities in the application of mandatory minimum sentences and the death penalty. They exposed the degree to which the criminal justice system was targeting Black and Latino Americans and sentencing them to extremely harsh terms in prison. And the Congressional Black Caucus sought to introduce the Racial Justice Act into the 94 crime bill, which would address these racial disparities. And Republicans refused to pass the legislation with this bill in tow. So for me, the real crime of this 94 crime bill is that policymakers chose to expand the prison system to place 100,000 new police officers on the streets of American cities, knowing that the system was deeply flawed and producing significant racial disparities within the application of various criminal justice provisions.
I remember covering some of the right-wing backlash to some of the prevention provisions in that Clinton crime bill. There was this brouhaha that maybe some of our listeners who were following the news back then will remember over what they called midnight basketball.
Right.
Which was, you know, supposed to be funding for programs that would be organized sports and other things late at night when teenagers might otherwise be on the street getting into trouble. And, oh, they're throwing money at BS programs that aren't really going to do anything, like midnight basketball. So I just say, and I remember some of that conservative backlash that tried to push prevention out of the bill. My guest is Dr. Elizabeth Hinton, professor of history and of African American studies at Harvard and author of the new book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. And people know of the LBJ War on Poverty. The Johnson administration also had what you call a war on crime.
Lyndon Johnson was the first president to call for a war on crime in March 1965.
And were crime rates rising when Johnson declared war? What was the context?
So contrary to popular belief and the kind of law and order rhetoric that Barry Goldwater evoked in his 64 campaign, rates of violent crime were lower than they were in the early 20th century and had remained relatively stable since the Prohibition period. What was new was the extent of collective urban violence beginning in the summer of 1964 in Harlem, Chicago, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, in Rochester, New York, where the National Guard was called, and the real fear that had been ongoing since the Kennedy administration that Black youth living in poverty in American cities would explode. The policymakers often referred to this group as social dynamite, and sure enough, they did. And the sensationalized coverage of urban uprisings throughout Johnson's presidency really, really reinforced fear and the sense that crime was on the rise and further rationalized the war on crime and sold it in many respects to the American public. Even though violent crime was not at an all-time high, as some senators like Strom Thurmond implied during that time.
And you're right that Johnson saw his war on crime as a complement to his Great Society programs.
Yes.
So how did the expansion of government in his welfare expansion and other anti-poverty initiatives set a precedent that later allowed for a new degree of federal influence in law enforcement, as you describe it?
So the war on so actually this begins with the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration, through its juvenile delinquency programs, launched the federal government's first urban intervention, where essentially Kennedy's President's Committee on Juvenile Delinquency funded organizations like Mobilization for Youth in the Lower East Side directly. The Johnson administration expands these kind of funding channels on a national scale with the War on Poverty. In many cases, he reframes many of the programs that Kennedy introduced, like early childhood education, which becomes Head Start, counseling programs, job training programs, etc. He reframes this juvenile delinquency program as a war on poverty, and the federal government begins funding grassroots organizations, begins taking on a larger role in trying to solve some of the problems of poverty, inequality, and inequality at the local level. So this sets a precedent and establishes channels between the federal government and municipalities and local organizations that eases the transition towards a more punitive forms of these social welfare programs.
How do you think we should remember Johnson's legacy overall? He did sign into law some of the most progressive legislation
right.
in our nation's history, Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the War on Poverty, various programs. And yet you write, the war on poverty is best understood not as an effort to broadly uplift communities or as a moral crusade to transform society by combating inequality or want, but as a manifestation of fear about urban disorder and about young African Americans.
Right. Johnson's legacy is really complicated. I mean, and this is the irony of him, the fact that he called the war on crime in March 65 in the first place. This is the height of the civil rights revolution and progressive social change in the United States. Yet at the same time, we get the introduction of these new kind of punitive programs at the national level and the call for the war on crime. The book, and I'm urging us to come to terms with the Great Society and the war on poverty in new ways, and the ways in which the set of assumptions that policymakers at the highest level of government had about African Americans, poverty, and crime limited the kind of range of responses that they designed, that they implemented in low-income urban communities. And these responses get more and more punitive as, in the absence of fundamental socioeconomic reform, as Congress said in the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, you know, the war on poverty was not about major structural change. It was about providing people with equal opportunity with job training, as Ramsey Clark wrote to Johnson in the aftermath of the Watts Uprising of 1965. The point was to, quote, help the disadvantaged, help himself. So it was in many ways seen by policymakers as a self-help program. In the absence of these major socioeconomic transformations, the uprisings continued. These uprisings were rooted in civil rights grievances. And instead of responding to problems of unemployment, failing school systems, deteriorating housing conditions, etc., with greater social welfare programs or even a Marshall Plan for American cities, as the Kerner Commission suggested in 1968, the response was increasingly more policing, an integration of social welfare and punitive programs, the empowerment of police departments to take on greater roles in municipal government and over community organizations, et cetera. So
go ahead. Sorry. You finished the thought.
I'm finished. Yeah. Yeah.
So where do you think we are now before you go? I mean, if your take on history is that crime control was the domestic policy issue back then when conservative and liberal interests most thoroughly intertwined. Now we have tentative bipartisan support for a sentencing reform bill. We have even the Koch brothers back in criminal justice reform, they
right.
say. Is crime control reform the issue that will bring together liberals and conservatives for today?
Well, it shouldn't surprise us that a bipartisan consensus of policymakers is now seeking to rethink our criminal justice priorities of the past half century, given that a bipartisan consensus of policymakers is what got us into this mess in the first place. I think that in going back to Johnson and some of the promises of the War on Poverty and the Great Society, the principle of maximum feasible participation, which policymakers at the national level really embraced only through the first year of the War on Poverty, so from 64 to 65, and this then becomes institutionalized, the idea that federal funds should go to grassroots organizations to empower communities to begin to solve their problems and to actually have an active role in shaping the implementation of programs that play a large role in their everyday lives. I think we need to return to this earlier principle and really give it a chance and let communities themselves begin to have a greater voice in the program shaping their lives. I think that this principle, especially if we empower citizens to take a more active role in the safety of their own communities and work with police departments, will change many of the very tense police community relations problems that we see, and the kind of targeted enforcement and aggressive enforcement of low-income Black and Latino communities.
Harvard Professor of History and African American Studies, Dr. Elizabeth Hinton, her new book is From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Thank you so much.
Thanks for a great conversation, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how simply can a person live? We'll have two guys here who are trying to find that answer.